There's a long tradition of black Americans singing the blues, and the origins of this style of music are rooted in the experience of black people who were effectively, if not literally, enslaved at the end of the 19th century. The music shared similarities with spirituals, with the Christian message and work songs, as well as traditional music brought with those who came as slaves from West Africa. In contrast to spiritual songs, which tended to offer hope in the midst of the times of trouble, the blues were, to use a category of the Old Testament Psalms, songs of lament. As well as singing about poverty, they also sang about physical disability. A number of black musicians were blind and included that in their name, such as Blind Willie Johnson and the Blind Boys of Alabama. And while the blues were especially associated with African-American singers, throughout the 20th century there were also a number of white American musicians who shared some of the life experiences of the black blues singers. There was one white musician who had also suffered in the way, same way as Blind Willie Johnson and the Boys of Alabama. Dick Burnett grew up at the beginning of the 20th century in rural Kentucky. He played the dulcimer, the fiddle, the banjo, and guitar. During the day, he worked in various manual jobs until he lost his sight in a mugging. He could no longer do the farming or industrial jobs that he had done in the past, and so decided to make his living, support his family with his music. And he went around collecting and arranging traditional Appalachian folk songs and singing in the bluegrass style associated with Kentucky. One of Dick Burnett's songs was made famous when it was used by the Coen brothers in a film a few years ago. The film was set in the 1930s in rural Mississippi, still the poorest of American states. And it tells the story of three convicts who've escaped from a chain gang. George Clooney plays Ulysses Everett McGill, who sings Dick Burnett's song, A Man of Constant Sorrow. Clooney's singing voice is dubbed by Dan Tominski, a contemporary bluegrass musician. We're going to hear a verse or two of Dan Tominski singing Burnett's song, along with Alison Krauss and Union Station. Thank you. I was thinking about that song when I was looking at our reading this evening. The passage comes from a section of the book of Isaiah that contains what are known as the servant songs. While the New Testament doesn't make a lot of the connection between those passages and the person of Jesus, the association is there, and for nearly 300 years, that connection has been emphasized by our familiarity with Handel's Messiah. In Handel's oratorio, Jesus, God's Messiah, is clearly shown to be the man of sorrows and acquainted with grief that's described by Isaiah. Let's hear a section of one of Handel's arias. This is Kathleen Ferrier in 1952 singing, He Was Despised and Rejected. I hope you can see a connection between those two pieces of music, a man of constant sorrow and a man of sorrows acquainted with grief. I guess the one significant difference between the lyrics of these two pieces of music is that A Man of Constant Sorrow is very much a first-person narrative. It's someone lamenting their own situation, while the lyric of Handel's music is in the third person. And yeah, there is definitely something similar in the emotion behind the two songs. They are both lamenting, being rejected, being left alone. There's also a sense, in my view, and I say in my view because I almost hesitate to say it, in which both of these songs are wallowing in misery. Now, that's sometimes said of country music today. My wife's gone off and my dog's just got run over. It probably isn't fair to say that the writers of blues songs were wallowing in their state. Their state was what it was. It was their state. And I guess the same is true of the music that's based in Isaiah. But it's easy to mistake the servant's giving himself up to ill treatment, like the sheep that was silent before the shearer, as softness or weakness. But when it comes to Jesus giving himself up, it would definitely be a mistake to think of him as being weak or soft. When they begin his course, there's a New Testament teacher who challenges his students to consider a pair of claims. The first is, Jesus was crucified for deeds he actually committed. And secondly, the officials who saw to Jesus' execution were simply doing their jobs. Now, those two statements may sound provocative, but the crucifixion of Jesus makes perfect sense in the cultural context of his day. And yet these statements are challenging, and the challenge emerges from the way that we talk about Jesus in church. Jesus was righteous, so he must have been innocent. But does righteousness require innocence? It does only if we think of righteousness in negative terms, as the absence of something, sin. But this can't account for the calling to which God calls the church. The church has a history of being against things. And so there is a danger that righteousness, as defined in Jewish and Christian contexts, is also seen as negative. But righteousness as the absence of sin, well, it can't nourish generosity, kindness, mercy, or curiosity. Think about that fourth one of the Beatitudes. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for justice, for righteousness. You can't hunger and thirst for the absence of something. Indeed, billions of people live starving for justice right now. Nor can righteousness, negatively conceived, account for heroes of the Christian faith who have found themselves in trouble. People like the recently beatified Saint Oscar Romero. People who have been in what is described as good trouble. The kind that got Archbishop Romero killed in El Salvador. The kind that got Dietrich Bonhoeffer killed in Nazi Germany. All of these people who got themselves martyred encountered good trouble. They all met violence as a result, mostly from the sanctioned authorities of their day. And all four of the gospel stories, the story of Jesus, tell two parallel stories concerning Jesus' arrest and crucifixion. One story emphasizes Jesus' innocence. The people who round him up have false motives. The witnesses against Jesus either lie or can't get their stories straight. Pontius Pilate knows Jesus is innocent, but hands him over anyway for crucifixion in order to placate the crowds. That's the familiar story, the story we are used to. But the other story, running concurrently with that one, emphasizes a chain of actually rather predictable events. Mark's presentation is the simplest, but the basics apply to all four Gospels. Jesus arrives in Jerusalem at Passover time, and it's a time that's fraught with tension. Every year, people are likely to get overwrought because the festival remembers and celebrates Israel's liberation from bondage from a previous overlord, Egypt. And during Passover, the city gets overcrowded and it gets a bit chaotic and tempers could flare. And Jesus then initiates two very symbolic acts. He organizes a procession into the city that inspires messianic fervor. And then he stages some sort of dramatic protest in the temple. Biblical scholars disagree concerning the symbolic importance of these acts, but they all agree that they lead to conflict. One group after another tests Jesus in public. Adding fuel to the flame, Jesus condemns paying taxes to Caesar, albeit with some sort of plausible deniability. And he accuses the temple authorities of taking advantage of the poor and the widowed. And tension mounts all the time. And so Jesus' enemies find a way to arrest him. And Jesus is on his way to the cross before you can blink your eye. Based on this way of looking at the story, Jesus dies because of things he actually did. And the authorities, whose primary duty is to maintain order, are just doing their jobs. So how might these twin declarations, Jesus' innocence and Jesus' righteousness, relate to our 2018 world with its overt attempts to suppress protest? In America, there has been a backlash against football players who protested police injustices against African Americans, and they kneel during the national anthem. President Trump has called for the team's owners, the NFL, to end their careers. Sack them. At a campaign rally just a few days ago, President Trump praised a fellow Republican politician who had attacked a journalist, a crime for which the politician was originally sentenced to 40 days in jail. In Turkey, it seems almost certain that Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist who's been critical of the regime in Saudi Arabia, was killed on the orders of the Saudi rulers. It's not like that here, is it? Well, actually, in our own country, three men were released from prison just this week after they successfully appealed 16-month sentences. 16 months. Because they peacefully protested a fracking site in Lancashire. No damage was done to property, they just sat in the road. One might think that powerful people are trying to silence those who hunger and thirst for justice. But it's far too tempting to identify Jesus directly as a protester. Perhaps he understood his symbolic actions as a form of protest, because perhaps his agenda had other dimensions. Nor should we, though, appropriate Jesus to our own causes. Say, well, he'd be on our side in this situation, as if our concerns were Jesus' own concerns. But on the other hand, we shouldn't imagine a sort of disembodied Jesus who's far removed from the concerns of his day, and therefore our day. Too often our imaginations fail to integrate the Jesus who died for us and rose again with the Jesus who confronted demonic powers, the Jesus who freed people from their infirmities, and the Jesus who established communities of dignity and mutual aid. That Jesus got himself killed through his dramatic behaviour. But after all, the authorities were only doing their jobs. The disciples of Jesus, like their master, were also threatened by enemies. Matthew records Jesus on one occasion cautioning his disciples, "See, I'm sending you out like sheep into the midst of wolves. So be wise as servants and innocent as doves. Beware of them, for they will hand you over to councils. They will flog you in their synagogues." That warning occurs in the context of opposition that awaited the disciples as they embarked on their mission to proclaim the good news. Just think what would have happened if they were proclaiming bad news. Jesus is calling upon his disciples to use good sense, to be aware of their situation, and to exercise wisdom in dealing with the danger before them. If they experience persecution in one town, they're to go on to the next. They're to be innocent as doves. But that doesn't mean to say they're to be naive. They should do all that they can to avoid being trapped by the wolves. If it turns out, however, that despite their carefulness, they are picked up and brought before their enemies, they're not to panic. At that time, when they are at the mercy of their enemies, they'll be able to give witness to their faith and their confidence in God. With the guidance of the Spirit, they'll find the right words to say. And in such a circumstance, their situation will be similar to that of the servant in Isaiah. In other words, they'll be powerless to escape, but they will be held firm by their confidence in God. And that was the response that Jesus made. When he could escape, he did so. But when in the Garden of Gethsemane he was surrounded by a large crowd with swords and clubs, as we read, he advised against violence. He told his disciples not to attempt to avoid capture. When we think about the actions of Jesus and the disciples, we think about times and places when we have to respond to Jesus. And we have to respond as Jesus, the suffering servant of God. One may be wise as well as faithful if one avoids or escapes danger when it's possible to do so. But finally, when one is fully overpowered, when the hour has come, one should stand unafraid. Unafraid with full reliance upon God, because that's all we have. We're called to make ourselves vulnerable, because in God we trust. We rely on him not just because he is strong, but also because he made himself weak. He allowed himself to take the very nature of a servant, humbling himself, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Amen.